Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, conservatives who used to despise Martin Luther King have warmed to his memory. But writer Rick Perlstein says the thaw is the result of an attempt to domesticate King, if you will, and omit from memory elements that challenged power and privilege and scared the establishment, conservatives and liberals alike. We'll talk to Rick Perlstein about why conservatives still don't get Martin Luther King. Also on the show, Sarah Olson is an independent reporter who conducted an interview last spring with Army First Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the first commissioned officer to refuse to deploy to Iraq. Several months later, Olson was served a subpoena calling on her to testify against Watada in his court-martial. Can journalists be forced to help the military make their case just for doing their job? We'll hear from Sarah Olson on her situation. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
There are times when the gap between the people and the press is hard to ignore. This is one of those times. To hear the pundits tell it, the public would never go for Congress cutting off funding for a troop increase in Iraq. As George Will explained on ABC's This Week on January 14th, war supporters wouldn't let such a measure get off the ground. And host George Stephanopoulos agreed the argument would be hard to sell. The ABC crew isn't alone in taking that line. Fox pundit Bill Salmon called the whole idea politically suicidal on January 15th. But who do these people talk to? The most recent Gallup poll actually found the public evenly split on whether Congress should cut off money for more troops in Iraq. But this is just a single note in the chorus we've heard from the press corps since the midterm elections, the theme of which is the Democrats were not elected to investigate the White House or to block their policies, but to usher in a new era of bipartisanship. The thing is, while that might be what pundits want, it's not what the public is saying. 61% say they want Congress to use its power to block the troop escalation in Iraq, according to the same USA Today Gallup poll, whether that's through funding or some other means. One has to wonder if it ever bothers these pundits that, pronounce as they will on what the public wants and doesn't, the public insists on having its own ideas.
Speaking of public press disconnects, press watchers know that corporate-owned media are frankly allergic to a universal single-payer health care system. Canadian-style health care is a punchline for mainstream pundits. Even when a proposal for such a plan had dozens of co-sponsors in Congress, it was dismissed by the media elite as not viable. Evidently, though, while corporate media's distaste for the reality of universal health care continues unabated, they do nowadays like to appear to support the idea of it. Hard to know what else explains the media accolades poured on California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger for his recently announced statewide plan. Critics like the California Nurses Association called the plan, which doesn't touch the central role of private insurers, a fresh coat of paint on a collapsing house. But media welcomed the proposal as a bold move in support of family values, as one paper had it, and they didn't hesitate to call it universal coverage. Though in some accounts, like the January 18th New York Times, that became near universal as the article went on. The Schwarzenegger plan, like the similarly vaunted Massachusetts plan, has things to recommend it, surely, but it's simply odd to see media embrace it for being a step toward health care for all when bigger steps in that direction have met press disinterest and worse. Few press celebrations of what the Washington Post called Arnold Care, for example, explained or even noted that when an actual universal health care bill was passed by the California State Senate in August, it would have provided health care coverage to all residents through a state-run single-payer system, ending the need for private companies. Schwarzenegger's response was a big fat veto. The message from the media? Universal health care is great, as long as it's not, you know, universal health care.
As Lewis Scooter Libby went to trial for perjury in the Valerie Plame leak case, the New York Times featured a front-page story on the former Cheney chief of staff. The January 17th profile, "As Trial Begins, Cheney's Ex-Aide Still a Puzzle," calls Libby a first-rate legal mind and describes him as hyper-cautious. The article also quotes Cheney aide Mary Matlin calling Libby a victim of the criminalization of politics, who ironically, according to Matlin, is not even political. To read the paper's front page is to learn that reporter Scott Shane thinks it's mysterious that Libby, this nice, not particularly partisan guy, has become mixed up in one of the biggest and most partisan political scandals of recent times. All of which is very mysterious to us. Libby's demeanor in the Plame Leak case would seem to call into question his vaunted caution, as well as his legal acumen. He's charged, remember, with lying repeatedly to federal investigators because, among other things, he claimed he learned Valerie Plame's CIA identity from NBC's Tim Russert, a claim Russert denies. Even stranger is the idea of Libby as non-political, as one of the most prominent Iraq hawks charged with selling the war based on non-existent weapons. Libby famously pressured Secretary of State Colin Powell to include inaccurate information in his crucial 2003 United Nations speech. His resume reveals him to be an early recruit to the neocon cause, a founding member of the Project for a New American Century, and an unstinting GOP loyalist. Information confirming Libby's involvement in partisan and political activities is included further down in the Times profile after the jump. But that he's aware of such things only deepens the strangeness of a reporter presenting Libby's involvement in such a partisan political scandal as a mystery.
A January 8th Washington Post article highlighted the Iraqi government's official estimate for war deaths: 22,950 Iraqi civilians and police officers died in 2006, according to the Iraqi Health Ministry. This number is dramatically lower than some other estimates of Iraqi casualties, notably the 650,000 excess war deaths since 2003, reported in the Lancet Medical Journal by researchers from Johns Hopkins Medical School. But the Lancet number, the Post explains, has been dismissed as inaccurate. And the official numbers put out by the Iraqi Health Ministry, quote, are believed to be more reliable than those issued by other sources because they are based solely on death certificates, close quote. Well, there's a little more context the Post might provide, but doesn't. Some readers might not know that the Iraqi Health Ministry is now controlled by followers of Muqtada al-Sadr, best known as the leader of the Mahdi Army. The U.S. military has asserted that the Shiite militia's control of the ministry has turned morgues and hospitals into places where death squads operate freely. Nevertheless, for the Washington Post, when you're talking about epidemiological survey methods, it's really the Mahdi Army you want to rely on, not those unprofessionals at Johns Hopkins.
And finally, last week we interviewed Dan Zimmerman, a lawyer for the blogger Spocko, whose website was shut down after Disney ABC lawyers contacted his internet provider objecting to its content. Spocko had posted audio clips of bigoted and violent commentary by hosts at the ABC-owned San Francisco radio station, KSFO, and, along with other bloggers, had contacted KSFO advertisers to let them know what they were sponsoring. As Zimmerman pointed out, Spocko's use of the audio was protected by the fair use principle, and he has since found another provider to host his website, clips and all. We played some of the clips on Counterspin, including one of KSFO host Brian Sussman insisting that a caller say, "Allah is a whore," and another where host Melanie Morgan commented about having a bullseye painted between Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi's eyes. Publicity for the case seemed to send KSFO into panic mode, so much so that on January 12th, the station canceled regular programming to air a three-hour special featuring four hosts, including Sussman and Morgan, who attempted to defend themselves by claiming the remarks were either dated or out of context. But ABC's attempts to silence or drown out the bloggers have only served to publicize their cause. As the New York Times put it on January 15th, quote, Spocko's campaign became more widely followed when his blog was taken down, close quote. The episode should serve as a lesson to media activists that, while their voices may be small compared to those sponsored by conglomerates like Disney ABC, there are still ways to be heard. Of course, that's a message for the big guys, too.
Thank you, Steve. You are listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
Each Martin Luther King holiday brings with it media coverage extolling King's less controversial views while usually ignoring his messages on poverty and war. In recent years, King has also gained favor among conservatives, with many a right-leaning pundit extolling the virtues of the civil rights icon. As Rick Perlstein points out, this wasn't always the case. In a January 10th article in the New Republic's online edition, Perlstein recalls right-wing rancor towards King while he was alive and argues that even as many conservatives warm to his memory, or some version of his memory, conservatives still don't get Martin Luther King. Rick Perlstein's book, Nixon Land, The Politics and Culture of an American Berserk, 1965 to 1975, will be published next year. Rick Perlstein joins us now by phone from Chicago. Rick Perlstein, welcome back to Counterspin.
Great to be here.
Well, you begin your piece recalling how conservatives received King while he was alive. Remind us of some of that history.
Well, they hated him. Basically, Martin Luther King's, fundamental idea was that some laws are so unjust that we should disobey them and risk the consequences and absorb the blows with loving kindness. And conservatives reinterpreted that to mean that if you don't like a law, you don't have to obey it. So anyone who breaks a law you can lay to the responsibility of Martin Luther King, who told people to be lawless. And there were some, pretty stunning examples of that. Even to the extent that people almost blamed him for his own assassination. Ronald Reagan said that this was just the sort of, quote, great tragedy that began when we began compromising with law and order and people started choosing which laws they'd break. And basically he was saying, well, if you say that people should be civilly disobedient, well, maybe that's what James Earl Ray was doing.
Well, just to be clear, the supposed liberal media was not exactly friendly to King either much of the time. Give us a couple of examples of that, if you will, as I know you recounted them.
Yeah, well, the New York Times, when King was in Birmingham in 1963, which was really the touchstone of the real veneration of King. I mean, he won the Nobel Prize basically for his crusade in Birmingham.
And his letter from a Birmingham jail included that argument for civil disobedience.
That's right. And one of the people he was kind of tacitly responding to was institutions like the New York Times, who said, well, there's a new mayor coming in Birmingham, and we should give him a chance to, accomplish what you're trying to accomplish with civil disobedience through the normal bureaucratic administrative channels. And why are you being so impatient? And in fact, he called his book on the Birmingham Crusade, Why We Can't Wait. The liberals were the people who said, basically, you should wait, you should be more patient.
What is it that has allowed conservatives to warm to King, do you think?
Well, his martyrdom certainly has helped. I mean, he's no longer a threat to anyone. It's pretty stunning. I was reading the book of Matthew the other day in the New Testament, and Jesus got it exactly right. I mean, he basically said, well, when these prophets were actually among you, you killed them. You hated them. And now you venerate them. I mean, it's Matthew book 23. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because ye build tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous. So that's basically what the right is doing now. They're building these kind of memorials to Martin Luther King. And then he says in the next verse, this is Jesus speaking, and say, if I had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. And then he says, wherefore ye be witnesses unto yourself that ye are the children of them which killed the prophets. So basically Jesus is saying that, you guys claim you would have venerated this dangerous prophet when he was around, but really you would have been just like the hypocrites who put him to death. Stunning.
Well, Rick Perlstein, in addition to the fact that he's no longer a threat, isn't there something about the way that the media has treated him, the way that media has sort of domesticated him, if you will, by sort of omitting some of the more threatening aspects of his life and his work?
Well, you really can't underestimate how controversial it was when he stepped up to that pulpit in New York at Riverside Church in 1967 and basically cut his ties with the Johnson administration by coming out against Vietnam War. Johnson was the great friend of civil rights, the great friend of liberals, and he basically said that America was becoming the focus of evil in the world. It was a stunning, stunning speech, and I think that we've forgotten just how stunning it was. We've also forgotten how stunning and frightening it was that he said that he was going to have 3,000 poor people camping on the Mall in the spring of 1968. This was planned for basically a couple of weeks after he was assassinated. The governor of Tennessee at the time said that he was training 3,000 people to riot in Washington, D.C. And, you know, we tend to remember the I Have a Dream and the kind of soft soap kind of we all should get along and be nice to each other, this kind of warm, cuddly king. But actually, in his own context, and especially towards the end of his life, although also at the beginning of his life, at the beginning of his public ministry in the 50s, he was really a scary figure. I mean, I like to say that there wasn't any time after 1955 in which he didn't face the threat of assassination.
Now, perhaps we're going over a little of the territory that you've already touched on, but the central point that you say conservatives don't get about Martin Luther King has to do with King's message, which has always been threatening to the status quo. As you put it, quote, the conservative response to King to demonize him in the 60s and to domesticate him today has always been essentially the same, close quote. Could you explain that a little more for us?
Right. Well, I was just reading about a new book about the suffragists in England in the early 20th century, and no one could possibly imagine women's suffrage being controversial. But basically, it was brought to England through, frankly, terrorism, the kind of thing that Martin Luther King would never have allowed for. They burned down like 14 buildings in a week, you know, the women's suffragists in England. And that kind of sort of dangerous, kind of outside the norms of society activity is generally what it takes to start the process of social change. And conservatives basically take the social change that we now all accept, and they take that as the kind of, they reify that as the meaning of the man. You know, the fact that, you know, like we all believe now that you should have to serve someone in a restaurant regardless of their race is the meaning of Martin Luther King. No, that's not true. The meaning of Martin Luther King is that there will always be injustices, and the courageous people in our own time always have to push the frontiers of fighting against injustice. I mean, if he were alive today, it might have been gay marriage. It certainly would have been the war in Iraq. He said the arc of the universe bends towards justice, which means there's always a new battle to fight. And conservatives are kind of about Martin Luther King being this guy who basically righted wrongs in the past that we all agree are, you know, moral enormities.
Well, one of the things that you don't touch on in your column has to do with how conservatives have embraced Martin Luther King by saying that because he is famous for that quote, saying that we should judge people on the content of their character and not on the color of their skin, that Martin Luther King would have been against affirmative action. This is something that is repeated in the press continually, and there's a regular media myth about it that he never weighed in on affirmative action because affirmative action didn't exist then. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that's pure up is downism. I mean, the word affirmative action was something that kind of came about and evolved slowly through the 60s, but the concept certainly was there, and Martin Luther King was foursquare for it. He understood that this was a question of power, that without African Americans in the formerly despised taking up institutional positions of power, that you couldn't have any social change, that this wasn't just an arid formal legal exercise. And, you know, he described things that we would have recognized today as affirmative action as something that, you know, warriors for social justice should absolutely be attending to. And the idea of judging people by the content of their character, not the color of their skin, that was the aspiration. And that was when, you know, he's seen the promised land. Once we get to the promised land, that's what the world will look like. And it certainly didn't preclude methods like, you know, race-specific remedies for previous discrimination. No way.
We've been speaking with Rick Perlstein. You can read his article, Conservatives Still Don't Get Martin Luther King, at the New Republic's pay website, tnr.com. Rick Perlstein, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
Aaron Watada is an Army first lieutenant who gained attention last summer when he became the first commissioned officer to refuse to deploy to Iraq. Watada explained that he does not oppose all war, but he does oppose this one, which he has called manifestly illegal. He faces a court-martial scheduled to begin in February. That's unsurprising, but what is raising eyebrows is that the military is charging Watada not just with missing a troop movement, but with conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. With the latter charge, usually reserved for crimes like manslaughter or rape, evidently based on public statements Watada has made questioning the war's rationale. The military hasn't used that disconcerting anti-dissent maneuver since Vietnam. But adding to the worry is that the Army is trying to force reporters to help prosecute its case. The reporter at the center of this troubling story is our next guest. Sarah Olson is an Oakland-based independent journalist and radio producer. Listeners may have heard her work on Making Contact, as well as in outlets including Truth Out, Free Speech Radio News, Alternet, and elsewhere. Sarah Olson joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, fill us in first, if you would, on just the basic facts of the story from your perspective. You interviewed Aaron Watada in May 2006, and then several months later, you wake up to a subpoena. Is that it?
Well, what happened was that I published an article in June based on the May 2006 interview I did with Lieutenant Watada. The interview was published on Truth Out, and I also produced radio pieces that aired on Pacifica Radio and the National Radio Project's Making Contact. As you say, Lieutenant Watada is currently facing one charge of missing troop movement or not going to Iraq, and four counts of conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. One of those counts is based on the interview Lieutenant Watada did with me and the statements he made in that interview. All four counts are based on statements Lieutenant Watada made in public or to individual journalists like myself. So to make those charges stick, the Army has subpoenaed myself and another journalist. They've added additional journalists to their possible witness list.
Well, what is it exactly that the Army wants from you?
The Army has been very savvy about what they want. They say that they would only like me to verify the accuracy of my reporting. And, you know, that's a terrible position for a journalist to be in. Every journalist wants to stand by their work, and I'm no different in this case. I'm actually quite proud of the work I've done on the Lieutenant Watada story, and I stand by its accuracy 100%. However, in this case, I think that what's happening is that the Army is attempting to force me, a journalist, to participate in the prosecution of my source and to participate in the prosecution, in this case, of personal political speech. And that is a situation that I think no journalist should be facing.
So even though they're on paper just asking you to confirm that Watada said to you what he said, the idea is that the charge is based around his act in making those statements.
That's right. And, you know, my concern here is that participating in this way in the court-martial, particularly of political speech, you'll erode the very necessary separation between press and government. And when you do that, any journalist can be seen as a possible witness. Any journalist can be seen as the investigative tool of the government.
Well, the Los Angeles Times has editorialized for the Army to back off in this case, and you've got support from groups like the Society of Professional Journalists, the Pan American Center. Even Military Reporters and Editors President James Crawley said, quote, "Trying to force a reporter to testify at a court-martial sends the wrong signal to the media and the military," close quote. He called it an abuse of trust. So this has raised questions in a number of quarters. It seems kind of unnecessary. I was going to ask you, why do you think the Army's going forward with this? It sounds like it's just for the chill of it, if you will.
Well, it's not real clear to me why the Army is going forward with it. As you were saying, I have produced this piece for radio. The Army can go to half a dozen different websites and download broadcast quality MP3 files of Lieutenant Watada's statements and listen to those themselves. Asking journalists to silence or control the dissent coming out of the military is a very dangerous thing to enter into.
Well, Aaron Watada faces up to 6 years if he's convicted. What is your situation? What are your options right now?
The court-martial starts on February 5th. If I am forced to go up to Fort Lewis and take the stand, I can choose between testifying and declining to testify. If I decline, I face a felony contempt of court charge and up to 6 months in prison.
Well, what can people do to support not just Sarah Olson, but to support the ability of reporters to resist becoming an arm of the state?
Well, certainly people have been writing letters to the commanding general at Fort Lewis and to the Secretary of Defense. People are advocating for stronger shield laws that protect independent journalists from having to participate in this kind of government prosecution. You know, and as you say, this is not something that is isolated to me. There is an independent journalist right now in California who on February 6th, he will become the longest jailed journalist in history, jailed for resisting a grand jury subpoena. Josh Wolf has been imprisoned for nearly 150 days at this point. He's also in this untenable predicament of being ordered to give over his video outtakes. Then there's, of course, the two San Francisco Chronicle reporters, the 10 media outlets that have received subpoenas as well, and, you know, just kind of a whole host of reporters and journalists facing subpoenas right at this moment. Of course, you can go to my website. That's Free Press Working Group. And the First Amendment Project is a project based in Oakland, California, that is representing me pro bono, and I think they should be supported as well.
We've been speaking with independent journalist and radio producer Sarah Olson. You can follow her story at Free Press Working Group. That's freepresswg.org, and find a way to get involved. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin, Sarah Olson.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call 1-800-847-3993. That number again, 1-800-847-3993. And be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. That's www.fair.org. That's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.